Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a joy to welcome writer, broadcaster, presenter and podcaster, Sam Delaney. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Chris.
Lovely to meet you. I'm a big fan of Top Flight Time Machine, and I'm just saying, it's a joy to see the Vita Modula in its full glory.
Well, yeah, the Vita Modula is my little podcasting studio I have here in my back garden, and where I record my own podcasts, and yeah, it's I'm very happy in it. It's my own little sanctuary, and it's not unheard of for me to listen to a bit of Beatles music here alone in the daytime.
Excellent. When did you first discover the Beatles? Can you remember?
Oh, I would have been very young, because obviously my parents would have certainly played it in the house. It would have been my mum. My dad wasn't really around. He kind of left when I was quite small, but I did see a lot of him. And both of my parents had been in and around music in the 60s. My dad and his brothers had a rock and roll club in Harrow Weald in North London when they were quite young. And it was very popular in the area, and they used to book rock and roll bands to come and play there. It was at the Harrow Weald Memorial Hall, and it was called the Big Beat Club. I think it was every Friday. And they booked The Who when they were still the High Numbers.
Oh, wow.
I think the Stones played there in their early days. There was no drink. It was like Coca-Cola only. And it was quite a young crowd. And it's actually where my parents met.
Oh,
because my mum snuck in when she was a bit too young, because my mum knew my dad's sister. My dad's sister had said, it was my auntie Mickey had said, oh, you can come, do you want to come to the Big Beat Club on Friday? And it's where everyone went. And my mum said, well, I could never get in, I'm too young. She went, don't worry, my brothers run it, I'll get you in.
Yeah.
So she took my mum down there and just gave the old, walked straight past the queue, gave the nod, and then introduced her to my dad. And it was sort of like love at first sight. And so the whole thing was rock and roll. Right. And my dad was really into it. And out of that, he became a road manager, first for Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. And there was a Beatles connection there, of course, because they recorded Got to Get You Into My Life, which was their biggest hit. And I remember my dad telling me that I think it was the piano part in that, they couldn't quite get right. So in the end, they had to ask Paul McCartney to lay it down himself, because their band couldn't play it as well as he had presented it to them. So he road managed Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. And then from there, he switched jobs and became road manager for quite a few years to the Searchers, who, of course, were another Merseybeat band.
Yeah.
And my mum and dad were on the road with the Searchers for a number of years. At one point, my dad toured Australia with them on the same tour as the Stones and Marianne Faithfull.
Wow.
So there was a lot of sort of that thing in my family. And the Searchers in particular became kind of family friends. My mum's still really good friends with one of the members today. And so I always had people coming around the house who had some connection to that kind of scene. And my dad had certainly been in Abbey Road and met John Lennon when he was sitting in on a recording session with another band. So they were sort of part of a kind of a scene. And they weren't, you know, well connected to the Beatles by any means, but their paths had crossed, and they loved music and they loved the Beatles, and they played. My mum would have played the Beatles. My dad, who I used to see at weekends, would have played it in the car. And so I got really into them. Then when I got to be a teenager, I became more sort of passionately into them in a more nerdy way. And it was great, because I used to go on car journeys with my dad at weekends or whatever. And I would just ask him loads and loads and loads of questions, mm-hmm. not just for like facts about them, but also just his thoughts and opinions on his favourite records and what he thought were great. And my dad's not, I wouldn't say he's a passionate bloke in any sense, really, because he sort of plays, he plays everything cool, my dad. He wouldn't want to ever admit to being like super into anything. But I knew it was a conversation that, you know, it's a dad I didn't live with. So you're trying to bond with him in various different ways when I was young. And I would say a love of the Beatles was one of the key things that my dad and I managed to bond over. Yeah, we had lots of other things in common, football in particular, but music, I'd loved to just ask him questions about the Beatles and just get his opinions on them. And he would speak in quite a lot of depth, because He'd actually written, you know, I think he would have quite liked to have been a pop star himself. He certainly had a lot of opinions on good pop songs and how they were written and stuff like that. And, you know, funny enough, he lives in St. John's Wood, my dad, these days. And that's just around the corner from Paul McCartney. And we were talking about him the other day and he still says, you know, yeah, he's the greatest songwriter of all time. And yeah, so that's my early experience of the Beatles. It's through my parents, particularly my dad.
Funny you mentioned Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, because Mick Green, who was in that band, is on the album that you've picked today, which is, depends how you pronounce it, I call it Chubba BCCP, because it sounds a bit like Obladi to me, but it's the Russian album, it's kind of known. Well, tell me why you've picked this one.
Well, the reason I picked this one is basically a massively personal story that is very amusing to me. Okay, I went to a school in Southwest London, a normal comprehensive school in the 80s. And when we were about 14 in what was then called the third year, and I guess now is called year nine, they said, we're taking you on there's a school trip coming up. And we expected it. We'd been on school trips. I love school trips. You know, they were always just such a laugh. And there'd been day trips to France, and then there'd been a week in Germany. And we thought it'd be something like that. And we said, where to? And the teacher said, we're going to Russia. And this was 1989. Okay, so right. We're still, you know, and this was like 1989. But, I mean, you know, it was the death throes, really, of communism. But it was still very much the Cold War. It was still the Cold War. It was the spring of 1989. The Berlin Wall came down that November. And the Soviet Union didn't really collapse for another couple of years. So they were taking us behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
Right. And it's amazing. Still to this day, people go, wow, how did the school do that? I think in those days it was the London Education Authority. And I have always suspected that a comprehensive school under the yoke of Thatcherism in the 80s, the unionised teaching profession. I always thought this is a bunch of left-wing teachers, right?
Yeah.
Who want to get us exposed to communism and perhaps brainwash us with it, right? I had no idea. It was obviously heavily subsidised. It wasn't something that our parents had to pay a bit of money, but not much, you know. It was a heavily subsidised school trip. And we all went to a bunch of these teachers. And I remember our teachers were very much kind of clichéd 80s sort of lefty kind of liberal teachers wearing a lot of kind of heavy wooden jewellery and whatnot. And, you know, but they were lovely, by the way. I mean, our teachers were really great and it was a real privilege. But as is the way, I've got a teenager myself now and it's like, you know, you never, they're entitled and they just don't really recognise the privilege that's being bestowed on them. So we just thought, oh yeah, sounds like a laugh, go to Russia. Yeah. And it was a week or just over a week, and the first half of the week was in what was then called Leningrad, and then we got this train, overnight train, which is a very amazing memory of this beautiful old fashioned ornate train going across Russia to Moscow for the second half of the week. And when we went, rather than think, oh, this is gonna be amazing, exposed to all this kind of fascinating culture and blah blah blah, we started researching what money you could make in Russia by getting Western goods into the country.
Yeah.
And we researched this somehow or another, and we found out that the currency was things like bottles of Coca-Cola, pairs of Levi jeans, and weirdly like Hubba Bubba bubblegum, right? Oh, right. So stuff that was like Americana, right? Yeah. Americana. Yeah. So we actually took, like some of us actually bought pairs of Levi's, especially to take and sell because they were being sold. Wow. You'd get paid in US dollars, large amounts of US dollars. But when we got there, they were like, you cannot, there was a sort of a guide who I took to be a part of the Soviet intelligence services who stuck with us like a limpet everywhere we went. Right?
Yeah. And how old were you at the time?
14. And she was like, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. And the key thing was, do not buy or sell anything people will approach you as Westerners in hotel lobbies. Do not speak to them. You will get in trouble. You could be arrested, blah, blah, blah. And we're just like a bunch of tow racks from like from London. Just like, yeah, whatever. We're only here to make money. Yeah. Anyway, what we'd also been told by my mate, one of my best mates, William Gallagher, his mum, Tina, she was a massive Beatles fan and collector. And she told us that there was a Paul McCartney album that had only ever been released in the Soviet Union. It was very hard to get outside the Soviet Union, but if we managed to smuggle them back, they could be worth thousands, right? Yes. Thousands, she said, yeah. Right? And so we were all about getting this Paul McCartney album. And I can tell you, it was nothing to do with the music on that album. I'll admit that up front, right? So we were getting up in the middle of the night after the teachers had checked we were asleep and going downstairs and having illicit meetings with black marketeers in the shadow of our hotel down like weird, scary back alleys where we were exchanging Levi's and bubblegum for US dollars, which we would take home. But also, we were holding stuff back and said, we don't want the money, we want the McCartney records. Because we thought that's where the real value is. And so in the end, they managed to rustle up a lot of these records. And we all, like me and all my mates, ended up going back to the UK with a few copies each in our bag. And we were so convinced that we'd basically struck gold by getting hold of these records that I remember on the plane on the way back, talking to each other about fantasizing about what we were going to do with the money once we sold these records back in the UK. And I remember genuinely, without an element of doubt in my mind, knowing that I had these three records in my bag, saying, I'm going to buy my mum a new car. My mum didn't have a car, or she had an old bang and it was falling to pieces or something. And my mum always is talking about dreaming about getting a new car. I'm going to get her a new car. That's how rich I thought I was going to be.
Yeah.
And there was a record shop at the bottom of my road in Chiswick, and it was called Spinning Disc. And it was kind of mainly old sort of rock and roll records. And the guy in there had a big quiff and everything. And I went in and I sort of presented this record with a big flourish, like, well, my friend, today is your lucky day. I have brought in something that is going to knock your socks off. I really made a big song and dance about it.
Yeah.
And he's like, come on then, impress me. And I pull it out. I said, I've just got back from bloody Russia. And I've got more, and there's more where this came from. And he just looked at it and shrugged and sort of went, yeah, I'll give you 15 quid for it. And I was like, 15 quid? He went, oh, the market's been flooded. Everyone's been doing this. There's loads of them. I was absolutely gutted. He said, come back in a few months. Maybe the market will be different. But I'm getting people coming in most days at the moment. So I go back in 6 months' time. He offered me 50 pence for it.
No.
And then about another year later, by which time I'm 16, I remember being really skinned, needed to buy something, God knows what, almost certainly marijuana. And just out of desperation, I just walked in and flogged it for 15 quid.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Did you try any other record shops or just him?
Well, I can't remember, but, you know, it being 1989, it wouldn't be like now you go on Discogs or eBay.
No.
You know, it was like what record shops buy. And in my local high street, there was an Our Price, there was Woolies, and there was this one independent record shop called Spinning Disc. So I thought, those are my options. I can't see Our Price or Woolies buying this. So it's Spinning Disc or bust. So it might be that he just had me on and played the long game. But my friends, who I don't know, they tried different routes. And no one really made the riches that we all expected. And nowadays, of course, I have a record player. I buy vinyl. I'm, you know, typical 47-year-old bloke wasting money on vinyl, buying records that I already own on CD and have those digital downloads. But I do recollect sort of my favourites. So I buy new stuff. But, I buy Beatles albums because I like to just have them like that. And I'd love to have that record now. Do you know what? I'd love to. But I don't. I sold it. I think I did have three. I think they all got sold. There might be one up in my mum's loft. I'm not sure. Maybe one of these days I'll have another look. But that record is that's the record that is sort of has the biggest kind of emotional memory attached to it in many ways. Although, looking back through the track listing now, all of these songs also remind me of my dad. Because the other thing that my dad used to always play in the car when I was very young was great classic rock and roll. And I loved that and still do. So I looked down this, like, you know, Little Richard,
Eddie Cochran, Fats Domino. The Everly Brothers are another band that both my parents absolutely loved and played all the time. So this is the music I was raised on. And I now know, of course, that this is the music that switched on Paul McCartney. And so it all is coming together, like seeing these tracks that he chose to put on this record to almost introduce young Soviets. The one thing that I do remember from my trip to the Soviet Union was how culturally unaware they were of anything to do with the West. So you assumed that the big elements of Western culture had seeped everywhere. But it was pre-internet. The Soviet Union were, you know, extremely effective at cutting off their young people from anything that had been going on in the West for the past 30 years, right? Since effectively teen culture had been born in the 50s. This was 30 years later, and for those 30 years, they had successfully sort of managed to keep that a secret from their own young people because they thought it was dangerous and it was a threat to their political system and the balance of their society. So I'm guessing this must be why, you know, because I remember I had a copy of Viz with me, and we went into a school and the kids were showing us things. There was an exchange where the kids were showing us things and we were showing them things back. And I hadn't really brought anything, but I had a copy of Viz in my rucksack and I got it out. And these Russian kids were absolutely put that, you know, it's like Buster Gonad in his unvisibly large chess course. And they're like, put that away now.
Really?
This is, we're not allowed. And I said, oh, is it because it's rude? They said, it's not that. We're just not allowed comics.
No way.
And I remember being really shocked because I'd sort of waltzed in the Soviet Union completely unaware and ignorant of the nature of like what was going on, you know, in the Eastern Bloc. And I was like, really? You're not allowed comics? Oh, that's weird. And they were like, absolutely not. This would be considered very disrespectful and, you know, it would be considered a crime to have something like this in your possession. And the other thing was they got up and they sung a sort of a folk song, these school children. And we all applauded. And then their teacher said, now you sing us a song. And we were like, no, we don't do that. And our teacher started going, listen, I know we hadn't prepared for this. We didn't know they were going to ask us. But it turns out this is like a very normal thing to do. And it's almost polite. And it'll be impolite if you don't. Mm. This is what people do. And I was like, oh. So I was probably one of the more confident, bigger mouthed, cockier members of the party. So I thought, well, I better take the lead here. So we went up and me and three other people sung Help by the Beatles because we just knew the words. I think it had just been released. I think a terrible cover version had been done for Comic Relief and it was in the charts at the time. But anyway, we all knew the Beatles version too and we knew the lyrics because there was a cover version that someone like French and Saunders had done. And we got up and just sung that, like, kind of knew 90% of the lyrics and muddled through it. But the kids didn't know it was like that scene in Back to the Future where you think they're going to know and they're like, oh, what's that? Did you make that yourself? No, it's by the Beatles, for crying out loud. And then they're like, well, we don't really know about who the Beatles are. So I was really stunned by that. But anyway, looking at these songs, I mean, obviously, that's what he's thinking. These kids in Russia haven't even... I'm not going to start them off with modern stuff. I'm going to take them back to where all this stuff starts. And I guess that is what informed his track choices on this album.
Just a quick bit of history. So it was recorded at Hog Hill, which is Paul's studio, on the 20th and 21st of July 1987. And as you say, it was released exclusively in the then USSR on either the 14th of September 1998 or the 31st of October. And you can't be sure. It's because of the nature of the time. It was eventually released to the rest of the world 3 years later in October 1991. The title is a Russian translation of Back in the USSR, and apparently the correct pronunciation is, excuse me, Snova v SSSR, but I call it Chopper. It's just easier. So, what we were talking about earlier as well, Paul worked with an incredibly eclectic bunch of session musicians to do these songs. So he had, as we said before, Mick Green, who was in Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. He was also in Johnny Kidd and the Pirates.
Oh, yeah.
And Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. And then you've got pianist Mick Gallagher from Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
Wow.
Very eclectic. Then bassist Nick Garvey from the Motors. Do you remember who did Airport?
No, I don't remember that.
Oh, you know, if you heard it, I bet. Two drummers, Chris Whitten, who was a session drummer who played on The Waterboys, The Hole of the Moon,
right,
and Julian Cope's World Shut Your Mouth.
Yeah.
And Henry Spinetti, who he'd previously worked with on Tug of War. And basically, they recorded 22 songs, and it was clearly meant to be a low-key release. Plan was, originally, Paul was going to release it in the UK outside of his usual distribution channels. So it looked like it had been smuggled in from the Soviet Union, and EMI basically didn't like that idea. But what Paul's manager did, he just printed up a few copies, did all the cover in Russian, got Roy Carr to do the liner notes and translate them into Russian, just to give to Paul as a Christmas present.
Right.
And Paul saw it and thought, oh man, I like this. So he decided to contact Melodia, which is a Soviet government-run record company, exclusively to print it with no exports. And originally they did 50,000 copies, which had 11 tracks. And these sold out so quickly that they then did a further 350,000. They had two bonus tracks. But for the UK, because I remember at the time, obviously I've heard your 1984 Top Flight Time Machine, which for me is probably the best year in pop music.
Yeah,
I was obsessed with
it. I agree, yeah.
I've got all the Frankie Goes to Hollywood 12-inches. Yeah. But this was around when Paul McCartney was starting to do the Frankie Goes to Hollywood ZTT, releasing multiple 12-inch extended version and long version.
Right.
And the only way you could hear any of these tracks in the UK was to get the 12 inches. And he put three songs on the B-side, three songs on a different version of the B-side. Uh-huh. So for 2 years, that's the only way you could get half of these tracks, was just by buying all these Paul McCartney 12 inches.
Right.
So it's a very strange thing. I kind of wish he'd not then released it properly in 1991, because it would just be this obscure thing.
Yeah.
And obviously you'd get more money for your ones as well.
Yeah, I would. That's right. That's right. I'm sure I've seen it pop up in shops and stuff a lot since then. I always kind of, my heart sinks a little bit because it takes me back to how gutted I was. But, you know, it's the way it goes. But, you know, I noticed when I was watching Get Back, when they kind of were, you know, struggling for inspiration, they just automatically did lapse into doing these kind of rock and roll standards. Almost instinctively, yeah. It's just what they did to fill time. Does McCartney still play these tracks live, these sorts of things, once in a while?
Oh, some of these he's played constantly, and it's usually at sound checks.
Right.
You'll hear some of these tracks.
Right.
And it's just his default. Like Lucille, when he formed Wings, and he was trying to find members for Wings, that was, right, do Lucille. It's like his default.
Yeah.
You know, that is what we start with, and then we take it from there, to this day.
Yeah. I love listening to that sort of music, whether it's McCartney or the originals. And I love hearing him just talk about that stuff and the effect it had on him. And again, it reminds me of the sort of stuff my dad used to say. That's the thing about the Beatles. They were so sort of like reminiscent of... My grandma was from Liverpool. And although my dad and his brothers grew up in London, I don't know, there was something that, you know, they were the same generation, same age, same sort of influences, same similar backgrounds, and also same sort of humour when you see the Beatles mucking around and being anarchic and taking the piss and being the first sort of blazing a trail for basically teenagers who were slightly less deferential to their elders and supposedly betters. That seemed like quite a new way to behave. And it always reminded me of how my brother and his brothers had been growing up. And there's a lot of parallels there, which I think, aside from the fact that I just love the Beatles' music and their style and their personalities anyway, I think there's also like an emotional thing that for some reason it always kind of reminds me of my dad when my dad was younger, before I would have known him.
Kansas City, which starts this, it's a Little Richard cover, and that's actually in Get Back, but it has also been a staple of the Beatles' live performances since they were at the Cavern. So it's been with them throughout their whole career. The Beatles met Little Richard in 1962 and shared a bill with him in Liverpool on the 12th and 28th of October, and again that November in the Star Club. According to John, they'd stand backstage at the Star Club and watch him play. And John said he used to sit and talk He used to read from the Bible backstage, and just to hear him talk, we'd sit around and listen. Apparently it was Brian Epstein that brought him to Hamburg. I still love him, and he's one of the greatest. The thing I find interesting about this, the version on this album, it's slightly different to the Beatles one that we sort of know and love. And basically what happened, when Little Richard originally released this, it was a sort of different song. And when he played it live, he used to do a medley with the B-side of Good Golly Miss Molly, which is called Hey, 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 Hey. So it'd be that version that we now know the Beatles did. Basically, they saw him do that medley live, pinched it, and then they started doing it. So it's basically them doing their magpie bit. But you wouldn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You would have thought that's how the song goes, but it makes more sense. And the hey, 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 hey at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there's four official Beatles recordings of Little Richard's songs. So you've got this one, Long Tall Sally. From the BBC sessions, you've got Ooh My Soul and Lucille, all of which were sung by Paul, notably. And Little Richard also inspired two Lennon-McCartney songs, I'm Down and Birthday. According to Paul, he said, I could do Little Richard's voice, which is a wild horse screaming thing. It's like an out-of-body experience. You have to leave your current sensibilities and go about a foot above your head to sing it. You have to actually go outside yourself. A lot of people were fans of Little Richard, so I used to sing his stuff, but there came a point where I wanted one of my own, so I wrote I'm Down. But yeah, I also love the story how they were recording Birthday on the 18th of September 1968, and they stopped the session so they could actually watch The Girl Can't Help It. This then inspired them to pull out all the stops. So they came back full of beans to finish it off. And yeah, interesting, that film featured Little Richard as well as another artist who's covered on this album, Eddie Cochran. And then you've got 20th Flight Rock, Eddie Cochran. In 1960, Eddie Cochran came to the UK and he was scheduled to play in Liverpool. And at this time, Ringo was still in Roy Storm and Hurricanes and were actually going to be on the same bill, but sadly Eddie died before that date. It's another bit of serendipity, because if he had, Ringo's band on a supporting bill with Eddie Cochran could have had a much higher profile. And some believe that if they had been more successful, he'd be less tempted to leave for another band, say The Beatles. This is obviously the song Paul played to John when they first met,
right,
on 6th of July 1957. So this is the song that got him into The Beatles. I think what you were saying before, it's with that view of just doing it in Russia, it's for Paul probably a very historic song.
Yeah.
So it's probably got a lot of weight for him, I think.
Yeah, I've just been reading the Craig Brown book at the moment and you know, and noticed that, you know, he goes back over that, him breaking out into that and John effectively saying, right, you're in. And so I guess that song is so seminal, really, to Beatles history and folklore, everything.
Yeah. What did you think of the book, by the way?
I absolutely love it. I haven't finished it yet. I've always loved Craig Brown, funnily enough. When it came out, I don't know why I didn't just devour it straight away. I must have been in the middle of other stuff, but I've always been a huge Craig Brown fan. But mainly like his comic writing, he writes and, you know, sort of spoof, satirical kind of columnists and stuff. And so I haven't actually read much of his straightforward non-fiction. But for me, you know, it's like one of my favourite writers writing about my all-time favourite band. But like sometimes there's, you know, there's no new stuff emerges. I mean, you must find this a lot with doing this pod. It's like sometimes no new stuff emerges for years. And then suddenly last year, there was like an avalanche, which was wonderful. It was really great, but for me, I think the book sold very well, but for me, I think it kind of came at the wrong time. I just thought, well, let's just add that to the list. My wife, who works in publishing, read it recently, and she's a lot less, she's a massive Beatles fan too, but she doesn't read that kind of music book very often. But she was raving about it, and it's not the sort of book she usually raves about. So I have started to read it, and I love it in more ways than I thought were possible. Because, you know, listen, I love the Beatles. I've always owned all the Beatles, you know, all the albums and stuff. But I'm not You know, I'm not a brilliant Beatles historian by any means, so there's a lot of stuff in there that is quite new to me, or that I was semi-familiar with, but I'm getting in a lot more detail. And also, I just find Craig Brown a very funny writer. I'm loving it, actually. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I thought he was a bit tough on Yoko.
Right.
He didn't seem to like Yoko much, but...
Funny enough, I know some people who may have a Yoko show in development for a big streamer, and if that comes off, I think that it will be a very, very positive sort of rendition or telling of a story that hasn't been told yet from Yoko's point of view. And I really hope that happens, because it sounds fantastic, and I think it'd be great. And it's an all-female team behind it, who I think, you know, probably... I know my wife has always been like, feels like there's a lot of misogyny surrounding the Yoko narrative. But
I'm seeing, every time I see Meghan Markle now,
yeah,
it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And possibly the same reasons.
Yeah.
Not great.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got some sympathy with that. And funnily enough, my wife, who's always said that about Yoko, did come away from the Craig Brown book saying, well, actually, she is, you know, if the stuff that's in this book is true, then maybe I was wrong. She went, but again, it's just hard to tell. You know, so if it, you know, a Yoko TV show dramatisation would certainly be something I'm sure we'd all be there for in a big way.
When you first said a Yoko TV show, I was thinking of something like, you know, Game for a Laugh or something hosted by Yoko.
A game show hosted by Yoko Ono would be marvellous. But yeah, Game for a Laugh, or just Play Your Cards Right. Pretty much any format, any classic game show format, if you imagine it, but then insert Yoko Ono as the host, it immediately sounds fantastic, doesn't it?
We have Lloyd Price's Lordy Miss Claudie, which features Fats Domino. But for years, the only way we could hear this was on the B-side of Once Upon a Long Ago. Roy Carr's liner notes on the album read, "The story of how, in 1952, white women in New Orleans would visit local record shops and ask for Lloyd Price's locally recorded Lordy Miss Claudie on the pretext of buying it as a gift for their black maid or housekeeper, has become not just a part of rock lore, but an indication as how music, if not Southern society, was becoming integrated. Lordy Miss Claudie is a pivotal song. It may have become number one rhythm and blues record in both the best-selling charts of such prestigious US music business magazines as Billboard and Cashbox, but more importantly, it became one of the first million-selling crossover hits, a black-orientated record that sold to white fans." So yeah, this song from 1952, which included Fats Domino and was also a successful cover by Elvis, but we can hear the Beatles singing this during the Get Back sessions, as well as the song's B-side, Mau Mau Blues. What did you think of Get Back, by the way?
I really loved it so much. It just filled me with a sort of a joy like no film or documentary has ever done before, because it just felt so kind of such a huge, incredible privilege to be effectively the people who sort of, the four men who kind of crafted not just music, but I just think the every element of popular culture that I grew up around had somehow been shaped by them. And to be able, and so the influence they've had on everything that I've grown up loving is, you know, can't be overstated. But then to sort of just be able to peep in and kind of be there watching them do those things was, I suppose it's like, you know, if you imagine like great artists from centuries ago, suddenly being able to sort of, if someone came in a time capsule and said, you can just watch them at work now. You know, they're not performing, they're just literally going about their business, they're doing the stuff.
Yeah.
You will see the birth of the things that have basically influenced you and inspired you and everyone around you in your whole world. It, you know, it's mind blowing. It was absolutely mind blowing, and I took away so much from it, and I'm sure I'll return to it again and again over the years. I went to at my local cinema. They did a screening, just of a shortened version and the whole rooftop concert, and they did a Q&A with Glyn Johns, who by the way was amazing and became pretty much my favourite guy in the world.
Yeah, I've heard you tell a story about this. I hope you tell it again.
Well, it was just hilarious. I mean, it's not really a story beginning, middle and end. It's just like the way, you know, there were a lot of, and forgive me because I'm sure there's people listening who may take messages, there's a lot of Beatles anoraks there, right? And I guess,
oh yeah,
and they had a lot of very detailed technical questions, very technical, about the production and the engineering processes on that record. And I can't tell you how disinterested Glyn Johns was in those questions and how unnerdish he was, but also how unimpressed he was by himself. So people say, you know, what were these legends, Glyn Johns, and what was it like, and da-da-da, and that, you know, he goes, well, I don't know, I just, you know, I turned up, they asked me to make the record, so I did the best I could. But probably, so he really downplayed everything, but in this hugely funny, self-deprecating way. But then he did say at the end about how he was a bit miffed by what happened afterwards, and why John Lennon, in an interview in The Telegraph years later, had sort of thrown him under the bus and blamed him for the original version of the record not being good enough. And he'd been quite upset by that, you know, and thought it was unfair. But then, whatever, he was really the Rolling Stones producer. You know, they'd kind of borrowed
him.
And so he said, anyway, it was a couple of years later, and he goes, oh, I was around at Keith Richards' house, I think it was. He goes, and Mick turned up, and he said, oh, I'm glad I bumped into you, Glyn, because I need you to help me record. And I said to him, Mick, I've told you, I'm not working with you guys anymore. I'm retired from the Rolling Stones. He said, no, we've got one more record. We've got an obligation to the record label to make one last record, but we don't want to make it. So we're just going to chuck together a load of old offcuts and give them that just to fulfill the obligation. So all
this
I want
is,
you to...
Metamorphosis. Yeah,
I don't know what it was. Yeah. I don't know.
Please do the Mick Jagger impression as
he
well.
Goes, oh, it's fine. You just got to come over. He goes, we got to go. I've got a studio in New York, and we'll just put all the stuff together and deliver that to them. And Glyn Johns went, well, when are you going? He goes, oh, I was going to go now if you want to come. He said, all right, fine, I'll come. Because I thought, well, they're going to fly me there and pay me. It sounds like an easy job. I'll do it. So he just went that day, left Keith Richards' house, got on a plane and flew to New York. He went, and we were in the studio, and he goes, it was a complete load of rubbish. But, you know, they just wanted to get it done, and I wasn't fussed either way. I was being paid, getting a free trip to New York. And at the end of the day, Mick said, what are you doing tonight? And I said, well, I don't know, I'll probably go back to the hotel room and have a bit of dinner. And he went, oh, do you want to come round to John Lennon's house? I'm going to see John Lennon. And he went, no, I don't want to see him. I'm not happy with him. He slagged me off in the bloody Telegraph a couple of years ago. I don't want to talk to him. Oh, don't be like that. Go on, come over. You can bury the hatchet with him. Go on. And he's gone, no, I don't want to come. He goes, no, come on. I don't want to go there on my own. I feel uncomfortable. He's there with his girlfriend. And so he wouldn't stop going on about it. So then he said, fine, I'll come. So then we got to his apartment building. And as we buzzed on the door, Mick said to me, now, come on, Glyn, behave yourself. Right. So we went in, and John was perfectly pleasant, and he was there with his girlfriend, who was, remind me of the name of his girlfriend.
Oh, May Pang.
Yeah, May Pang. He said, and it was perfectly pleasant, and we were perfectly civil with each other, and we had some wine and just watched telly, which I thought was hilarious in itself. But Mick Jagger went round to John Lennon's house just to watch a bit of telly. But then we thought, well, in the 70s, telly was still relatively exotic. And American telly, in particular, was really exotic. Because when you went to America in those days, it was like, oh, they've got so many channels and so many outrageous shows, you know. So I'd love to know what they watched. You didn't go into that. I'm imagining they watched like Kojak or something like that. The four of them, May Pang, Lennon, Jagger and Glyn John just sitting, drinking wine, watching telly. And then he goes, at the end of the night, we said, right, we're going home now. And they ordered a taxi to pick us up, take us to our hotel. And as we were walking out, I thought to myself, well, I've got to say something. I can't just leave that bring up. So John said, oh, nice to see you again, Glyn. Thanks for coming over. And I said, I have to ask you, what was all that stuff in the Telegraph about? And Mick's going, oh, no, Glyn, I told you not to bring it up. Oh, God. And he's going, oh, yeah, look, speak to Paul about that. I wasn't in a good place mentally at the time. Just speak to Paul about it. And the interviewer at this Q&A said to Glyn, well, what did you think about that? He goes, well, I thought it was a real cop-out. He said, because he had hurt me. He'd said something that was unfair. And rather than just apologise, what he basically said was, I've apologised to Paul, and Paul's accepted my apology for my behaviour in that period, in the immediate aftermath of the Beatles, and therefore speak to him, and he will explain to you why you should forgive me. Anyway, yeah. Bye. So that was Glyn Johns' point of view. The other thing about that evening was there was a guy crying in the front row and during the film. And in the Q&A afterwards, he put his hand up and actually said, I'm very emotional during that. I cried. I've watched it three times and I've cried every time. And I thought, bloody hell, it's only been out about a month. I can't believe he's watched it three times, right? Yeah. I'm struggling to even get through it once. And he said, it's very emotional. You know, it just brings back so many memories of my own youth. And Glyn Johns was fascinated by this. He goes, I've got no idea why people feel so emotional about it. Don't feel like that at all myself. I'd feel embarrassed watching it, if anything. Mm. And then I thought, I've got to see who this geezer is. He's cried. And he's going up to the front at the end and just to pay his dues to Glyn Johns. So I sort of scurry up because I'd only seen this bloke from the back. And when I get up right close and have a good look at him, it was Brian Cox, the actor.
No.
Yeah. Wow. It was Brian Cox, the actor, out of numerous things, but most recently Succession, in which he plays a very scary media overlord. Yeah. But he was anything but that night. He was in tears watching the Beatles record, you know. So anyway, yeah, that film is absolutely amazing to me. Absolutely amazing. One of the greatest, I can't overstate, I don't know how you feel about it, I just can't overstate what an important piece of history that is and what a huge effect it had on me, and I'm sure everyone who watched it. If you ever
Sam Cooke's Bring It On Home To Me. Arguably, Paul did an even better version of this in 2006, which is on an album by George Benson and Al Jarreau. And during George and Al's recording sessions for Bring It On Home To Me, Paul turned up, unannounced, to pay his respects. And when he heard it pumping out the speakers, apparently George Benson noticed that Paul knew the song inside out. So he asked Paul to sing it with them, to which Paul replied, "Bloody hell, can you believe the cheek of this guy? I'm here doing my own record and he asked me to sing on his record." George later said he kept his promise. He said, well, I'm going to do my own thing. He said, but if I get some time off, I'll come back. And he did it because he loved me and Al. He said, George, I can do one take. But boy, did he tear that thing up. I said, not only did he know the song, I mean, he was deep inside it. His interpretation was really off the cuff, real different. It was almost like a miracle that happened. Interesting thing about this to me is that John Lennon's Rock and Roll album in 1975, he did a cover of it as well.
Oh, is that
so
right?
So it's interesting. You can compare the two versions.
Yeah, and which one's better?
Yeah, are you asking me?
I'll guess and say that McCartney's is, but...
Yeah, I have an issue with some of the John on the Rock and Roll album. To me, it sounds very much like Shawaddy Waddy.
Right, okay.
It's got a lot of brass on it. But then... It's John. It's difficult. You can't really compare the two. It's interesting how they do two different versions, but also the fact that they are the songs that they grew up with. They were going around each other's houses, borrowing records. pinching records sometimes. And it's their, like you say before, it's their default straight back, right, what are we going to do? Oh, yeah. But they would have been sitting there together listening to them.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I think that's beautiful.
It's interesting that there's a couple of Elvis songs on side two, because the only artist that I know my dad talks about with the same sort of reverence and nostalgia as the Beatles is Elvis. And the Beatles obviously felt that way about him too. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, it was almost like a rivalry, you know, and you hear all these stories about how Elvis didn't like the Beatles and almost tried to sabotage the Beatles in various ways. So you think of them as almost like two opposites. But in fact, you know, he's put two Elvis songs here. And just like my dad, who said it was the biggest musical memory he has, the most explosive, you know, revolutionary musical memory, is hearing it and seeing Elvis for the first time, long before the Beatles. And I guess that's how they felt too. I mean, I don't know. I just want to keep asking you questions here because you know more than me. I mean, was there resentment once they knew that Elvis had tried to sort of sabotage them all?
Yeah, I think from John's point of view, he was saying Elvis died when he joined the army for him.
Right.
But that's John. You know, John Lennon interviews are impossible because it depends what month it was.
Right.
What was going on with him. So I think that was around his sort of primal scream therapy era. But I think as time goes on, the recollections are more pleasant. But I think the rivalry, it was more from Elvis's side, I'd say. I don't think they were that fussed, really. I think they kind of knew that they'd usurped him in every possible sense.
Yeah.
Apologies to any Elvis fans out there, but that's what I think. And he clearly held the resentment and, you know, trying to get busted and hanging around with the president and all that kind of stuff. It must have eaten away at him.
He actually said, if in the transcriptions from that meeting he had with Nixon, the Beatles actually come up and he specifically warns Nixon that the Beatles are a threat to American youth. And Nixon seems quite engaged by that idea as well. He seems not entirely sure who the Beatles even are, which is a sign of the times. These are the days when politicians didn't feel obliged to be steeped in popular culture. In fact, quite the opposite. They were perfectly happy to rise above it. So it's quite funny because Nixon's a bit sort of like, the Beatles, I think I know who you're talking about. But he seems quite engaged when Elvis says, yeah, these guys, we've got to stop these guys. They're a threat.
Yeah.
I mean, was that just ego or commercial rivalry? Or?
I think it must have eaten away at him. Because before he left, you know, he went to the army, they'd still got a stockpile of songs that they were releasing while he was away, so his career kind of kept going. Mm. And then when he came back, then he was doing more sort of lightweight stuff. And then suddenly everything changed once the British bands conquered America.
Yeah.
And he was immediately out of date within probably a couple of years. Mm. I mean, the Elvis he called it the Elvis Comeback Special in 1968.
Yeah.
He'd only been around sort of 10 years or whatever, and he's not really...
yeah. So in can't have a comeback mind, after 10 years.
Yeah, but in his mind, he must have thought, yeah, I was over in 66 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he sort of turned into the Vegas years. But there's also an interview with John just before he died, and he was talking about when the Beatles split up, because now we look at it and we know the story, but he didn't know what was going to happen. And he was saying he was considering at one point going to Vegas and doing that kind of thing. Ringo was approached to do Vegas as well.
Wow.
Which would have been...
How would that have worked?
I think Ringo would have done a good job, actually.
Mm.
You know?
Certainly got... Yeah, you can see the Vegas vibe, especially in later era Ringo, for sure.
Yeah.
I can picture it. I can picture the glitter, yeah.
Ringo, you go for a night out, watch Ringo at Vegas, and then come home and watch Yoko's game show.
Yeah, well, now you're talking.
Where you belong.
of Little Richard's Lucille, which was also famously done by the Everly Brothers. And Paul said that he and John used to pretend they were the Everly Brothers. He said, when John and I first started to write songs, I was Phil and he was Don. Years later, when I finally met Phil, I was completely starstruck and at the same time extremely impressed by his humility and gentleness of soul. In 1984, the Everlys actually recorded a song Paul had composed just for them, On the Wings of a Nightingale. And in Get Back, we can also see John and Paul doing a particularly touching version of Bye Bye Love, just after a bit where they've fallen out with George Harrison, who looks really grumpy.
Yeah.
And both of those were huge influences on the Beatles. From their first few albums, you can just pick one after the other, aren't you, that are influenced by those two.
Yeah, especially the Everly Brothers harmonising. I guess the way that they sang together was like the biggest influence, really, wasn't it, on the way that Lennon and McCartney and Harrison all sung together.
Yeah.
I mean, the Everly Brothers would have been the other band that the cassette would have been played to death in the car. And I remember being so enamoured by it, and my favourite song being Cathy's Clown, that I actually... When I was quite young, when I was about 11, so at primary school, I could ask for an album for my birthday, and I asked for the Best of the Everly Brothers, which was kind of, I would have been like, that would have been 1985 or 1986 or something like that. It's quite nerdy. Do you know what I mean? You were not going to really impress many people in 1986 with your street cred by having the Best of the Everly Brothers. But I remember being quite shameless about liking that kind of music, even in front of mates. I wasn't too bothered. So I liked modern music too, but I never had any shame at all about putting on the Beatles or the Everly Brothers or what have you.
That's rare, isn't it? I think most people in their teens.
Yeah.
Later teens, perhaps. It's just
very... Later teens, you start showing that you've got this sort of like breadth of knowledge and you want to sort of drop some names. But certainly when you're younger, my daughter's 15, she's just coming round to some of the bands that I've been banging on about for years. Although, interestingly, neither of my kids are that into Beatles. They were when they were very young. Now they've dropped them completely and deemed them to be boring. But I'm just thinking, just you wait. It'll hit you again. And when it does, that'll be it. And with the Beatles, I don't think you even need to do much pushing because it will just happen. If they're into music at all, it will happen for them again at some point. Yeah. I remember my daughter when she was very young, we used to come home, she used to always want to watch the video to Hello Goodbye, where they're in the Sgt. Pepper brightly coloured outfits, which obviously appealed to her aesthetically when she was quite young. But then as a result, she became obsessed with the song. And we went through this period where she'd come home from school, get out of her coat and shoes, and sit down straight in front of the computer and ask for us to watch that. And we would watch it on a daily basis. And until I was almost sick of the song, in all honesty. And then since then, she's like, oh, the Beatles are boring. But I'm thinking, I'll give it another year, then she'll have a Beatles t-shirt.
Yes. I love the story Pete Perfidi's told, that he taught his daughter opposites, what the meaning of opposites, by playing a Hello Goodbye.
Oh, that's fantastic.
When she was
a
little kid. Yeah, sorry. One thing about this song as well, I mean, the Beatles, we've got recordings of them doing it at the BBC sessions, but there's also, this was one of the songs that John and Paul recorded after the breakup in a jam session in 1974, along with Stevie Wonder. And I don't know if you've ever heard that. It's not great listening, because John's absolutely off his head.
Right. I don't think I've heard it.
Oh, it's... They basically all headed back to John's, very much like Glyn John's story. And they just picked up some instruments, started jamming. I think Paul played drums, Stevie Wonder on keyboards, and I think Jesse Ed Davis, can't remember who else was there. But yeah, John is furious. He's screaming at the engineer about his headphones not working properly. It's quite a sad thing. That's the last recording we've got of John and Paul together. But yeah, if you ever want to listen to something odd... it's out there. Don't Get Round Much Anymore, which also appeared on the B-side of the Once Upon a Long Ago single. Interesting about this, when Paul was promoting the single, he was also promoting his All The Best compilation. So he was invited to appear on Jonathan Ross's Last Resort. But instead of pushing the single, the album, he performed songs from the Russian album, which nobody at the time could get. So he did this, Lordiness Claudie, as well as I Saw Her Standing There.
No, that's the... And it doesn't sort of fit the rest of the sort of track listing, really, does it, stylistically?
No.
It's strange, like, that he... I don't know how he would have made his decisions on these tracks. Because that kind of really stands out. I mean, to be honest, so Sam Cooke does in a way. You know, for Little Richard, Eddie Cock and Fats Domino. And then Sam Cooke, which is a fantastic song, fantastic artist, but it kind of changes gear slightly, and then suddenly you're on to Duke Ellington. But fair play to him. I think, you know, yeah, again, he must have been thinking, I'll take young Russian kids on a whistle-stop tour of every important type of music that I think that they've missed out on, that would give them the grounding they require to appreciate pop music since then.
Over to side two, and as with nearly all the songs on the album, another one recorded in one take. It's Elvis Presley's That's Alright Mama. We can hear the Beatles version of this on Live at the BBC, which was originally recorded for the Pop Go the Beatles on 2nd of July 1963 at Maida Vale Studios. And although they performed lots of Elvis songs, there's actually only a few that have been officially released, and all way after the band had split. So we've got this. From the BBC sessions, we've got I Forgot to Remember to Forget, and I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Cry Over You, also on the Star Club album, as well as a jam which appears on the White Album box set, You're So Square Baby I Don't Care, and there's also footage from 1994 of the Three Tools during Anthology, playing the B-side of That's Alright Mama, Blue Moon of Kentucky. But again, yeah, that's sort of like saying that's the beginning of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Here you go, here's your education. But yeah, it's weird hearing the Beatles version as well, doing Elvis in the same way it's weird hearing Elvis sing Beatles songs. It's sort of like Ne'er the Twain Shall Meet for me a bit.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah, although Beatles covers, I don't know, you know, you can hear some, we were in a cafe the other day and they were playing covers of the Bee Gees. There were cover versions of all the songs from the Saturday Night Fever album. And it was so bad that I had to ask the waiter to turn it down. I originally asked him to turn it off, and he said no. And I said, will you at least turn it down? And he, in the end, he was like, okay. Now, I love the Bee Gees. I see them in the songwriting tradition of Lennon and McCartney. But these were so bad that I was like, I thought there were certain bands who can't be covered. Because unless it's them doing it themselves, it sounds awful. The Beatles have, you know, I just think, obviously, I assume they've been covered more than any other artist. But their cover versions by other artists, I always think, are unusually successful by whoever it is. You know, and you hear all different genres and artists. You hear ska and reggae versions of the Beatles. You know, you can hear Elvis doing it. You hear a huge amount of soul artists doing the Beatles. And the tunes stand up no matter what kind of genre or style is applied to them.
Yes, definitely.
Which is quite rare. I can't think of another big artist that has that. Although, there is a great reggae Radiohead album. That's the only one that I can think of.
They did, I was trying to remember, they did an album, Sgt. Pepper Knew My Father, which was the NME, and it had that wet, wet, wet version of With a Little Help from My Friends.
Oh, yeah. I think that was a charity one, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It was, yeah. But there was a great version of Within You, Without You by Sonic Youth.
Oh, Sonic Youth. Oh, I'll look that up. I love it. I love listening to Beatles covers.
Yeah. Oh, The Fall. They do A Day in the Life.
Do they?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I've got to listen to that. Yeah.
Have a listen. It's really good.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Goodbye. crying and ashamed. My tears fell like rain.
So then we got Fats Domino again, Ain't That a Shame. This was released on the B-side of the 12-inch of My Brave Face. Again, it was the only way you could hear these songs at the time. It's another thing where you can compare it, because John did it on his rock and roll album. And Paul sort of sticks to the original rhythm, which is, I think, great. I think this is the highlight of the album, actually. I think he sings it so well. But John's, again, it's veering into sort of shawaddy waddy. I don't know what, I just thought it is. I think it's the brass.
Yeah,
but it's this is a great song.
Ain't That a Shame is a really, like, so evocative of my childhood, singing along to that. It's a beautiful, it's an amazing song. And yeah, it just makes me really happy when you think of Paul McCartney picking these songs out that you already love. And when you get a Paul McCartney approval on anything that you liked anyway, it makes it extra special for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I even listened to him recently on the Table Manners podcast, which I think he did quite a while ago, but I only just got recently around to listen to it, in which he described his favourite sandwich recipe. And I was so taken by it, I went and made it myself.
Is this the bagels one?
Bagel with hummus and Marmite and cheese in it.
How you made it?
I mean, I'm a vegetarian, you know, yeah. Obviously like him. So I was particularly interested in what he ate. I mean, in my time, I've interviewed a lot of different famous people and a lot of musicians. And I used to write in the NME and for The Guardian about music. And so I've been lucky to interview a lot of people. And actually, I think a lot of journalists have their trademark question that they chuck in to every interview, no matter who it is. And mine might sound very boring, but I am always fascinated to ask what they eat. Because you think of super successful, very, very famous people only eating fine foods crafted by personal chefs or what have you. But everyone, it's one of the things that is universal and unites all of us. The great leveller is snacking. Everyone snacks, yeah?
Yes.
Even the Queen probably snacked. Even King Charles himself sometimes will be sitting around and think, do you know what, I'm just going to get myself so I can't even bother getting the butler to get it, right? And so the Paul McCartney, to me, the idea of Paul McCartney still just being snacky and making himself a sandwich and having those sort of slightly perverse, weird tastes that we all have that are personal just to us, but you think no one else would like. A signature snack, if you will.
Yes.
And his was Marmite with hummus. I believe that when he first spoke about his love of Marmite and hummus combined, that Marmite or a hummus manufacturer, I'm not sure which, actually released a combo product in response to Paul McCartney's endorsement.
Because the secret, apparently, is the lettuce leaf to stop it all falling out.
To stop things falling through the hole. Yeah, I mean, I live for stuff like that. I mean, Paul McCartney, I could listen to a podcast of just Paul McCartney with snack advice every week, as I'm sure you could too.
And what was your verdict?
It was amazing. It was delicious.
Was it?
Funnily enough, the best he also prescribes having cheddar cheese in it or whatever cheese you've got. But I think he said, you know, for him it would be cheddar. And the best, I happen to think that cheddar cheese is the... Sorry, I know this is a Beatles podcast and now I'm talking
Keep
about
going,
cheese.
I love it.
Okay. I happen to think cheddar cheese is the best cheese in the world. And I think that people just lose sight of that because it's so commonplace in England, right? Or in Britain. And that we're so used to it, because it's just what you grow up with, that we don't think of it as an exceptional cheese. But it is, right? It's the Beatles of cheeses, right? It's the best cheese. And the best cheddar I've ever bought, funnily enough, was called Mull of Kintyre cheddar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And there was a, what do you call it, a cheesery? I'm not sure. But a cheese manufacturing compound.
Conglomerate.
In Mull of Kintyre. That made this incredible extra mature cheddar that was sold to Sainsbury's and released as part of their Taste the Difference range. And it was the most wildly delicious cheese I've ever tasted. And then at the beginning of lockdown, they discontinued it.
No.
And I couldn't find it anywhere else. I looked it up desperately online and it seemed that the Mull of Kintyre cheesery was shutting down. Right.
Oh no.
And I don't know if it was a result of lockdown, and that you could only buy it in bulk because there was obviously some sort of fire sale going on. In fact, me and my podcast partner, Andy Dawson, because I've got him into it as well, to the Mullican Tajada, at one point we thought maybe we should buy it and save it. Well, we didn't get round to it. I don't think we could have afforded it, in all honesty. But, another McCartney connection. Anyway, sorry, massive digression into cheese. But I don't think it's coincidental that my favourite all-time cheese was named after a place that was really synonymous with Paul McCartney.
What a link. It's a
great link. But honestly, my feelings about Paul McCartney are, I kind of would slavishly follow his taste or advice on any matter.
There's a video of him making mashed potato. I don't know if you've seen
it. I've heard about that, but I haven't seen it. He talks about that on the Table Manners podcast. Apparently he's very good at that, yeah.
It's very good.
He also talks about eye yoga, which there's also a video of him performing on YouTube, apparently.
Yeah.
And he says that the reason, despite he's well into his 70s, he's never had to have glasses, not even reading glasses, because a yogi taught him many years ago about eye yoga, working the muscles of the eyes to keep them healthy. And he apparently practices that every day. And you can watch him do. I mean, you probably have. Have you seen him doing eye yoga on YouTube?
I have, yeah.
Yeah,
I did try it myself, but I don't know if I could keep it up, really.
Give you a headache. Well, apparently his daughter, Mary McCartney, who's also on this podcast, says that it's her favourite thing when she's had a few drinks and her mates around. It's her go-to YouTube video. She delights in showing it to her friends when they're a bit pissed. It's like, look at my dad doing eye yoga on YouTube.
The Beatles met Fats Domino in New Orleans on the 16th of September 1964. It's actually George Harrison who was the real fanboy. And there are a couple of photos of the Fats playing guitar while Fats sits down, and it's possibly that they were singing I'm in Love Again. There's a quote from George where he says, "The main thing that really buzzed me, even before I heard Elvis, was Fats Domino's I'm in Love Again. I can see exactly where I was when I heard that. There was this little place near where I was born called Wavertree, a district. And right at that point, there's a thing called the Picton Clock Tower. This tower in the middle of the road with this clock on it. And then nearby, there used to be this old Art Deco cinema called the Abbey. I was just walking down the road when I heard Fats Domino. I thought, yes, it's me, and I'm in love again. It must have been on a radio or record player somewhere, and it touched somewhere deep in me." This is a big inspiration for Paul, who says he sang Lady Madonna in his Fats Domino voice. His quote was, "We were excited to meet Fats once in his hometown of New Orleans. He was wearing a huge star-spangled diamond-encrusted watch, which was our first encounter with bling. His voice, piano playing, and musical style was a huge influence on us. And his appearance in the film The Girl Can't Help It was truly magnificent. As one of my favourite rock and roll singers, I'll remember him fondly and always think of him with that twinkle in his eye. I read that he had 8 children. He himself was named Antoine. His kids were named Antoine III, Anatoly, Andre, Antonio, Antoinette, Andrea, Anola, and Adonica. Now that is pure facts."
Screaming about the money I spend. Quit bugging me. Yeah, yeah, he's cracking up. Yeah, yeah, he's cracking up.
Track 3 is Cracking Up by Bo Diddley. We can hear the Beatles mess around with this song during the Get Back Let It Be sessions. Wings also do a cover of Bo Diddley in 1979 for Buddy Holly Week, and there's also a soundcheck version from 1990 which appears on Paul's Trip in the Light Fantastic album.
This is a very Paul thing. He's kind of veering into a cod reggae version.
Oh no.
And every
like,
now
live
and again.
And die.
Yeah, that kind of thing, I suppose. But he keeps veering, his accent keeps veering dangerously, perilously close. Only in a couple of occasions, but there's a few tracks, I think. Jeff Lloyd has been on before, who said apparently Paul was very keen on doing his accents, but I think people have now told him, you know, tone it down a bit.
Best not to.
Best not.
Well, my friend Simon London, who would be a great guest on this actually, is a very brilliant TV producer, and he is black, and he used to always, but he's a big Beatles fan, but he did used to always say that there was something slightly iffy about the reggae break in Live and Let Die. he said, and he has this sort of thing where he used to make up funny stories, like funny but completely fictitious stories behind the song. And he used to say to me, you know that with Live and Let Die, Cubby Broccoli called up Paul McCartney quite short notice and said, look, Shirley Bassey's dropped out. Are you up for doing the new Bond thing? But we need it really quick. And McCartney said, well, yeah, look, I love Bond. I am up for doing this. But I'm not going to have time to watch the film. And Cubby Broccoli go, don't worry about that. It's a Bond film. What do you need to know? And he goes, well, at least tell me a little bit more about specifics. He said, well, a lot of it's set in Harlem. And, you know, and he goes, oh, so it features a lot of the African-American community. And he's gone, yeah. And Paul McCartney's gone, say no more. I've got just the idea. And he's gone straight into the studio and introduced this weird bit. What does it matter to you when you got a job to do? And Simon London always says that, yeah, if you see the original footage, he's wearing one of those Rasta hats with the fake dreads coming out.
Oh,
none of this is true. But no. This was the perspective of a black friend who said it sounds a little bit heavy-handed that Paul McCartney has decided to shoehorn in a slightly incongruous reggae break to a rock and roll song. And he's got his suspicions as to why Paul decided to do that.
There's a lot of reggae, actually, in Paul's career. He's done loads of stuff. Because Linda was hugely into it. That was her bag. She was really into reggae. I think she introduced him to all the sort of Trojan albums and
right.
Whatnot. But if you think, in the 70s, there was a lot of that going on. You had Eric Clapton doing I Shot the Sheriff and the Stones. Mm. They were all sort of veering into rock star white man doing reggae vibe. There was quite a bit of it going on.
Yeah, long before Sting got hold of it.
Yes.
And the Eagles. I mean, people often say that Hotel California is effectively a reggae track.
Really?
Yeah, have you never heard that said before? Listen it back. The bass to it. On a dark desert highway. It's got, the guitar sort of dominates. But if you listen to the rhythm of it, there's a reggae vibe going on.
Yes.
It's one of the great white reggae tracks.
Yeah. Now that's what I call
white reggae. Yeah,
got to be an album there.
Well, just because you think you're so pretty, and just because your mama thinks you're hot, just because you think you got something, I know why you have got. Well, you know you maybe spend all the money. You left and you're gonna be old Santa Claus. Ooh, I'm telling you, baby, I'm through with you. Because, well, just because.
Track 4's Just Because by Elvis Presley. Paul also recorded a cover of Elvis's It's Now or Never, which didn't actually appear on this album, but it turned up on the NME compilation The Last Temptation of Elvis, alongside cover versions by Bruce Springsteen, The Pogues, The Blow Monkeys, and Pop Police itself. Again, it's teaching people the history of music, really. Paul's got Bill Black's bass, hasn't he, that he played with Elvis Presley, keeps that in his studio. And he did that, he played that on his last album as well, so obviously very close to when you were saying before about, you know, did they resent Elvis? He clearly didn't. You know, he bought this thing and he's still playing it. I think he knows he's part of history as is Elvis. I don't know.
Yeah.
Must be hard knowing that.
I think that Paul McCartney is, all the activity you've seen him doing recently and listening to him talking about sandwich making and stuff, you get a lot of, again, my career in journalism, one of the things that kind of annoys me most, one of the cliches that I've always tried to rail against is journalists who habitually describe any celebrity that they've met and interviewed in their copy as refreshingly down to earth. It's the most common refrain. Journalists often do it because for two reasons. One is that that's exactly what the star and the star's publicists want them to say and try to steer them towards. And also, the journalist is starstruck, which is a sin for a journalist to be like that. and they think they are down to earth simply by existing, i.e. as long as you're not literally Mariah Carey demanding puppies to be brought into the room. If you do anything normal, like sit on a sofa or have a cup of tea, a journalist could think, oh my God, they're just normal like you and me. And yes, it's bollocks. It's very often bollocks. And I've interviewed countless musicians who have had not even 1/1,000,000th of Paul McCartney's talent or success, but who have behaved as if they were bigger than Elvis himself.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's a pretty hard thing to endure. And sometimes you think, when I used to interview like young rock bands, and the point at which I started to become disillusioned with that was when I was becoming older than them, and I sort of was fed up of sitting with lads who are a lot younger than me, who were almost condescending and playing it cool about what I was there to speak to them about. And sometimes I think, well, they're creative people. You've got to respect that. These are artists. They are frustrated. They're understandably suspicious and sceptical about the press. They find it hard to express what they're doing in their art beyond the art itself. And all of those things you have to respect and understand. But then you see Paul McCartney and you hear him just talking about making his favourite sandwich with a bit of cheddar and Marmite. And you think,
yeah,
that's Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
He's bigger than them all. He's bigger than all of them. No one's written as many songs, brilliant songs, ever in the history of pop music as Paul McCartney has, right? And you sort of think, lads, if he can do this, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure he's had his moments, but at the end of the day, haven't we all? And I'm sure he might get the ump or shout sometimes or be demanding or peculiar, of course. But Paul McCartney, the way he is, however sane he is and to me comes across as very sane. Yeah. It's like a million times more sane than he's got any right to be.
Yes.
I mean, being that guy is something that should, you know, should send you barmy by rights. So the fact that he is in a position where he still even knows what the word sandwich means is quite remarkable to me.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, I hate all that, oh, they're so refreshingly down to earth, because it's never true and it's lazy journalism. But in Paul McCartney's case, I would say that's practically the only person that you could legitimately say it about, because it's incredible and I love him for that, and I think it's legit. I choose to believe it's legit.
I do, because he told Bob Mortimer his favourite show was Holmes Under the Hammer.
Yeah, which I mean, it's just amazing. That's just
which
beautiful.
That, for some reason, reveals a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
a huge amount. And I didn't know that, actually, but that is absolutely, that's just such a beautiful thing. And I love him for all that stuff. You know, and when you watch Get Back, maybe one of the things that sort of struck me most was just like how nice they all were, first of all. Again, having spent time around, I've been in recording studios with bands. Again, bands, obviously, any band I named is smaller than the Beatles, because every band ever is smaller than the Beatles, where there is so much pomposity and pretentiousness, but also meanness, you know, kind of using your status against those lower than you, or those who are sort of in some way dependent on you. And it's really horrible to see. And, you see a lot of that in all walks of life, but particularly in celebrity and show business. And to see the way that the Beatles were, not just to each other, but to the people who worked for them and around them, that they were so consistently kind of polite and pleasant. And there were so many pleases and thank yous, small things like that, for a band who were not just recently big, that they were, you know, they were very well established by that stage as the biggest band and the biggest pop cultural phenomenon on the planet. And they're there drinking their cups of tea and eating their toast and marmalade, and they're saying their please and thank yous to everyone. And they're not losing their temper. Very occasionally they semi-lose their temper with each other. But even then, the fact that Paul clearly finds John so funny, and all of John's mucking about must be so frustrating, because Paul just wants to get the record made and John doesn't seem that engaged in that. And yet he can't help but laugh at his antics.
Yeah.
There's something so sweet about that, where you've got a mate who's kind of annoying, but you're such old mates. You just find him so funny that he wins you over. It's just irresistible.
Yeah.
You know,
you can see why people who met John just wanted to be his friend.
Yeah, and you just think, isn't it wonderful that people talk about all this rivalry that existed or contempt or bitterness, but you can just see in their eyes when they're facing each other and writing that there is something beautiful there. And the real pity, you know, I'm a recovering addict myself, and you think about John, you think the real pity is for John, because, you know, he accidentally let that all go as a result of, you know, addiction, abusing things that he shouldn't have been. And it was a shame, because that wasn't the real him. The real him is when he's standing face to face and they're both playing so close to each other, their noses are practically touching, and just creating this amazing stuff with your old mate that you've known since you were a kid. I mean, yeah. You know, so when you see it and then you think about what kind of happened next, you can feel tearful, can't you? Yeah, we can all get a bit Brian Cox.
Wake up early in the morning, in the ding-dong way.
We end this album with Midnight Special, which again goes with your theory, because this was like an old blues song, Lead Belly.
Mm.
So we are literally from 1918, 1925, somewhere around there. Mm. And that's the beginning of modern music, isn't it, really, the blues?
Yeah. Why is it down as traditional folk song? Is it like sort of uncredited, no one knows where it came from?
Yes, it is that old. Paul's performed this lots of times, and we can see him do it in 1991 on MTV Unplugged. It's thought to have originated from prisoners in the Deep South. The Chobber liner notes read, "Midnight Special is public domain, and anyone personally rearranging the song has the legal right to claim a composer credit. The legendary blues artist Lead Belly first claimed it sometime between 1918 and 1925 when serving time for murder in Harlem, an all-black Texas prison. The prison, which no longer exists, was located near Sugarland, just outside of Houston, and the words of the song, 'Let the Midnight Special shine its ever-loving light on me,' refers to the prison myth that if the light of the train from Houston shone on an inmate, he would be freed."
Right.
So it's that old.
Yeah.
One of the songs that's not on the original version is Summertime, the Gershwin
song. Oh, okay.
And I don't know if you know the story about the Beatles recording of this.
No, I don't.
Oh, you'll love this. So, 15th of October 1960. So it's John, Paul, George, Pete Best and Stuart Sutcliffe are the band.
Mm.
And there was a guy called Lou Waters, who was Rory Storm's bass player, and he'd paid to have a little recording made of himself. The Beatles went along, but Pete Best wasn't there, and Stuart Sutcliffe didn't play on it, but they recorded this song, Summertime.
Mm.
So the only drummer who was available was Ringo Starr. So out there, there's a recording of John, Paul, George and Ringo in 1960.
Wow.
Recording Summertime. Rumoured to have also recorded Fever.
Wow.
And September Song. There were 6 copies printed onto an acetate, but apparently none are known to have survived. But there might be one out there, and that would be... Wow. It changed history. But, yeah, so they closed with that.
So do you spend a lot of time and money on acquiring these kind of obscurities?
I used to in the 90s, before the internet. I used to go to lots of record fairs and buy all the sort of bootlegs. There was so many of them around at the time.
Right.
And then the internet sort of kicked. So I've got like shelves of the stuff, but you can just chuck them on your computer now. But it's nice, as you know, if someone who buys vinyl, to have it in your hand, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
See these little things. And they're so well made.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you asked me when we first were discussing me and prospects of me coming on this podcast, you asked me about, you know, what record I like to talk about. And I floated the idea of the White Album. You asked me if I had the special edition. I said I didn't. And then I later realised that I actually did on vinyl. Because I had bought it on vinyl when it had come out. And or when it was re-released. Was it re-released in recent years?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Yeah, so I got it then. But I actually haven't played it much. It was just that it's an album that means a huge amount to me and that I love. And that I just, at the time, was buying quite a lot of vinyl, and I had a new sort of record player, and I was trying to recollect all of my favourites. Yeah. And so I got it. But it's funny, you know, like, you know, I live in a house where I've got my record player and all the stuff that goes with it are out in the main living space. And, you know, I've got family who are not always particularly sympathetic to me sticking on an album in the middle of where we eat and watch TV and all the rest of it. And so it's very rare that I actually really think I've got some time to myself in an empty house. And I almost ceremonially place a record. The rest of the time, I've just got my AirPods in and listen to all the same music on Spotify, to be honest.
I think that's the same for a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of the box sets I've bought, I kind of play them avidly for the first few weeks. And then it's just a fag having to keep taking it out and trying not to bend the book. And, I'll listen to it on streaming instead.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Could have saved myself a fortune. So, Sam Delaney, thanks so much. I mean, I'm guessing this album, I think this is an original, but there's a lot of bootlegs around.
See the little star? Like, there's a big star around Paul McCartney's face, and then there's a smaller one. Is that, what colour is that on your record? Is that sort of goldy orange? Yeah, so I can't remember, but you might know, that I remember at the time we were going around buying these records and some had that star was gold and some that star was red, the same red as the rest of the design. And there was some conjecture about what the difference was. And I think the gold star one was regarded as that. That one's worth even more. You'll get 10 grand for a gold starer. I've no idea whether that's true, but that's just brought back a memory there. You showed me that cover. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, overall, what does this album mean to you? I'm guessing it's childhood memories.
Yeah, as you can tell, you know, this is not an album that, you know, the music had the huge effect on me. It's the memory of the circumstances surrounding my acquisition of this album. That said, talking about the songs on it that Paul covered, is very nostalgic for me, because particularly the rock and roll stuff, it was the stuff that played a huge part. It was the first type of pop music that I was introduced to and loved when I was very young, and I loved all those songs from a very, very early age. And still now, those songs really give me a kind of a sort of Proustian rush when I hear them, or even think about songs like Lucille or Ain't That a Shame. And so really at the time, again, I talked about the entitlement of youth, and that goes for not just us getting the opportunity to go to Russia and ignoring all of the cultural wonders we were being exposed to in favour of just, you know, flogging stuff and buying stuff. It also refers to the fact that I got my hands on a beautiful album by, you know, a guy who even then, but particularly now, is like my all-time favourite artist, and I didn't pay enough attention to the music on that album. All I paid attention to was how much money can I get for it. But I'm glad those days are gone. And that I can look back now and sort of appreciate more of the actual art that was there.
Sam Delaney, thank you so much. It's been a joy.
My pleasure. Thank you. Hey!